Hello and welcome once again to another new episode of PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this week we're revisiting the Precambrian and the organisms of Mistaken Point with the University of Cambridge's Dr. Emily Mitchell. We originally visited Mistaken Point in episode 5 with Dr. Alex Liu, so if you've not yet listened or if you're new to the show, I'd recommend listening to that first. It gives a great introduction to the area and the accompanying pictures really show what it's like on the Newfoundland coast. So, we've got the whole history of life to talk about, so why revisit the rangiomorphs or rangiomorphs? Well, they're still quite a bit of a mystery. Nobody really knows what they are exactly. But Emily's recent Nature paper revealed quite a lot of information hidden in their spatial distributions. Well, thanks for joining us, Emily. As always, when we have a new interviewee on the show, we ask a few questions about you and how you got into paleontology and why, and how did you end up at Cambridge studying the Ediacaran?
So I actually came quite a long winding route. I started off life as a theoretical physicist and actually was doing maths research for a while. But I wanted to do something that could be more easily related to the real world. So I moved into, well, from theoretical physics to theoretical ecology. And that's how I got, in contact with Nick Butterfield, who was my PhD supervisor. He had a PhD available, which was looking at the structure of ecosystems through deep time, in particular across the Ediacaran Cambrian boundary. And my PhD originally was quite theoretical, looking at modelling different types of food webs. However, once I started getting interested in looking into the fossils, I found out all about the Ediacaran and I found it absolutely mesmerizing. You have all these kind of strange forms that we don't really understand. What also very much appealed about the Ediacaran is that you have them preserved so well, kind of non-mobile organisms preserved in the bedding planes, kind of entire ecosystems, which means you can do a lot of really, really nice analysis. Whereas if you, for example, looking at the Burgess Shale, it's a lot harder to get good ideas of what kind of preservation biases you have and what the real proportions of the communities were. So my PhD went from being theoretical about the Cambrian to statistical about the Ediacaran.
So it must have been quite an amazing leap of faith to go from theoretical physics into paleontology. Were you there thinking like, what am I doing?
When I saw the PhD advertised, I was very, very interested in it. And it seemed like if you want to understand how modern ecosystems function, going back to the point where they first started developing, in terms of macroorganisms, it seemed really appealing because modern ecosystems are so complicated and you have so many complicated interactions. If you go back to where you only have a few organisms and you don't have kind of highly evolved types of interactions, it seemed a lot simpler. But having said that, when I got the PhD, I did have to be told all about rocks, for example, that there are three different types. I knew nothing about any kind of geology, which is a little bit embarrassing actually, but I'm very glad that I did move. It is wonderful being able to study these early organisms.
So we have covered them on PaleoCast before. We had episode 5 with Alex Liu all about the Ediacaran of Mistaken Point. And that's a great place to start if you've not yet listened to that. But can we have a brief rundown of what's happening around the time? So what was the world like immediately before we see the Ediacaran biota?
So before the Ediacaran, you only had microbial life. And in fact, for a very long time, on the Earth, for 2 billion years, you just have microbial life, microbes floating around. And you do get different forms and they do get a little bit more complicated. But it's only actually during the Ediacaran that you first see large macroorganisms for the first time.
So what are these macroorganisms like? How do we define them? What are they?
So there's a huge variety of Ediacaran forms, but the Rangimorphs in particular are very, very interesting because they look like nothing else that's alive today, or indeed outside the Ediacaran in the fossil record. What's so distinctive about them is they've got this amazing kind of fractal-like branching pattern where you have primary branches, and then off those branches you have more branches and then more branches, and sometimes you get four or five orders of branching. So they have this very, very unique branching pattern. In some ways it's quite similar to plants or trees, but because Mistaken Point communities, for example, were in very, very deep water, we know they couldn't have been photosynthetic, which makes it very, very hard to work out what their closest relatives were. They certainly weren't plants, but relating them to animals, for example, is very tricky because they don't have any animal features. There were quite a lot of different forms in Mistaken Point communities, about 30 odd different types of taxa, and all with different types of branching structures. Some had stems and attached to the microbial mats they lived on via holdfast discs and were kind of vertical in the water column, and others, like Fractifusus, actually lay directly on the microbial mats on the sea bottom.
As a mathematician, have you ever looked into the fractal patterning?
I myself haven't. My colleague Jen at Cambridge earlier this year actually looked into it and produced models that show that kind of described all this fractal branching. Which was a very key step, because people have been talking about how Rangimorphs branch fractally, quote unquote, but no one had actually kind of shown that they were fractally branching in a mathematically defined way.
So we know the morphology or the shape of them, but can we say anything about their ecology, like how they interacted with their environment?
Very, very little is known about their basic ecology. We know they lived in the deep sea. We don't see any feeding structures, so we think that they got their energy by absorbing nutrients through their membrane walls from the water column. But one of the things that I'm actually working on currently is using spatial analysis to look at how they interacted with their environment and what kind of impacts the environment had on them.
So the Ediacaran was a very peaceful and quiet place to be. There were no predators then?
No, it was very peaceful. There were no predators. And actually, from Mistaken Point, which is one of the oldest Ediacaran communities, you don't see any evidence of even herbivory. You don't see any evidence of creatures eating anything really at all. You do in younger assemblages in the Ediacaran, you see kind of scratch marks in the microbial mats and kind of imprints where they're thought different species were thought to kind of land and then absorb the microbial mat through the underside. But yes, the Mistaken Point communities are incredibly peaceful. Everything was just living peacefully on the sea bottom, apart from, of course, the volcanic ash that killed them. That's definitely not peaceful.
That was a bit of a downer, I guess.
Yes, it was.
Do we see any evidence of them moving around? You mentioned the little scratch marks. Could they move?
So younger Ediacarans could move around. In Mistaken Point, we don't see any evidence for mobility on the bedding planes that we studied. However, there are some possible trace marks that Alex Slew found very near the bedding planes that of the Mistaken Point macrofossils. So while there wasn't any motility in the communities that we studied, there could quite have easily been organisms around in the time period that might have been able to move, perhaps only in extreme circumstances. But we're not sure what they were or what they looked like.
So when did the biota go extinct? When did we lose the Rangiomorphs?
So Rangiomorphs themselves were present in various forms throughout the Ediacaran. And when you get to the Cambrian, you actually don't see them anymore. There are one or two possible Ediacaran survivors. And when I say one or two, I mean one or two fossils as opposed to one or two species. So there are just a couple of specimens. So they really were present only during the Ediacaran. We're not sure how exactly or why they went extinct, whether it was a mass extinction, whether we just stopped seeing them in the fossil record because the preservation conditions changed, or whether they were kind of slowly and gradually outcompeted by their Cambrian counterparts.
Now, have I imagined this, but didn't someone claim not so long ago to have found a modern Rangiomorph that they dredged up from somewhere?
There were some very strange creatures that looked a little bit like Ediacarans that were found in deep sea samples, but they were very, very different. But you can understand why to the untrained eye, they did have some superficial resemblances.
And you don't think that we might be able to find one still just surviving somewhere in the deep water, nice and quiet?
That would be so much fun to suddenly kind of chance upon a whole kind of Rangiomorph community in the deep ocean. But I would be rather surprised. I think, you never know. It's possible, but I think given that we don't see them for essentially 540 million years, I think it'd be rather surprising if one popped up now.
Yeah, half a billion years is quite a long time to have a Lazarus taxon.
Yes, indeed it is.
You mentioned your spatial analysis that you've done, and you've recently published that in a little journal called Nature. So this was a novel approach to examining the Rangiomorph communities. So can you tell us what you actually did?
Yes, so it's quite difficult working with Rangiomorphs because they look so different from everything that's alive today. But they have a huge advantage, which is they didn't move around and they're preserved where they lived, which means the position of them on the bedding planes reflects the ecological and biological processes that they were subject to during life. Which means if we map out where the fossils are and analyse the distribution of their positions, their using spatial analysis, we can then try and start to work out what processes did affect them during life. So what we did is we mapped out the fossils on three different bedding planes in Newfoundland, Canada. It was probably a total of three and a half weeks. I mapped out mistaken point D and E surfaces using differential GPS, which is, in principle, it's the same as GPS used for a car. But because that's only accurate to a few meters, I needed an extra transmitter to set up in between the satellite and the GPS receiver. And adding in this transmitter to the process means that I could get down to millimeter accuracy.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's really, and the equipment actually will tell you how accurate you're being. So I think the average kind of XY accuracy was something like 1.7 millimeters. It was really, really small. And then my colleagues, Alex Liu, Charlotte Kennington, and Jack Matthews mapped out another bedding plane in the Bonavista Peninsula in Newfoundland. And this we tried a different approach, which is essentially covering the bedding plane with acetate and drawing around all the kind of outlines of the fossils. And what this approach allowed us to do is also capture the shape, the size, as well as positions. So in total, we mapped out over 5,000 specimens. But what was good about Fractifusus is that on each of the three bedding planes, we had over 1,000 specimens, which is wonderful if you're doing statistical analysis, because the more points you have, the more kind of detailed you can look into the data and work out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And the fact we have so many specimens across different bedding planes means that if we find a pattern, we can then test to see if it occurs again, see whether it's to essentially confirm it. So while we actually analysed other species, the numbers weren't sufficient on other bedding planes to actually kind of confirm any theories about how they reproduced, for example.
All right, so have the bedding planes not been mapped out before?
They have indeed. So in about 2000 to 2003, Matt Clapham and Mark Laflamme mapped out the mistaken point communities. This was done in two dimensions, not three. And they did some really good paleoecological analysis on the data. The H14 surface in Bonavista Peninsula hasn't been previously mapped out. Clapham and co. Did a lot of really good paleoecological analysis, and they included some basic nearest neighbour spatial analysis, mm-hmm. which at the time was very much cutting edge. But since then, our ability to do spatial analysis has increased massively, and in large part due to the increase in computational power. So with nearest neighbours analysis, which is what Clapham and did, is basically you could look at the points or the fossils and say, are these do these behave in a random fashion, or are they clustered together, or are they spaced out? And it was quite a simple kind of yes, no, what are they doing? Whereas what we did is took it to kind of a much, much kind of higher level of detail. So we could not only tell whether things were clustered or not, we could tell them tell what happens in their behavior over a wide spatial area. So with nearest neighbor analysis, you're counting kind of from each fossil to its nearest neighbor. But the problem is this, if all fossils are found very close together, for example, Fractifusus, if they're always within 20 centimeters of another Fractifusus, what that means is you're only looking at what happens within 20 centimeters. So you have no idea what's going on the larger scale. You also have no way to describe the magnitude of the interaction or the shape of the distribution. So what our paracorrelation analysis allowed us to do is actually, because we have a very detailed description of the spatial patterns, we can compare different models. So for example, if you have a spatial pattern which is due to an environmental variable, for example, with trees, good quality soil, you get one sort of spatial pattern. But if you've got a spatial pattern that's due to reproductive processes, like trees kind of spawning seeds around them, you get a totally different type of cluster pattern. And so what we could do is pick which the most likely models were.
Well, before we get into the results, I'd just like to clarify a couple of things with the methods.
Sure.
The bedding planes at Mistaken Point aren't all horizontal, are they? Are they dipping?
I think there's about 15, 20 degrees.
And so did you have to correct for this?
Well, yes. So, but I mean, it's just rotating essentially a plane in 3D space. So it's not particularly difficult. But what we did need to do at Mistaken Point is the bedding planes had undergone some tectonic deformation. So you could see ripples in them. Mm-hmm. And what I needed to do is kind of correct for that. And that was a lot tricky. And so that required doing some retro deformation, which people generally do with Mistaken Point bedding planes by measuring the holdfast discs of fossils, assuming they're circular, and then essentially stretching out the bedding plane to make the kind of the holdfast discs to turn them from kind of oval shaped and back into their original circle shape.
And then you looked at the spatial data and then also the size of the specimens, but did
yes.
you look as to the orientation of them as well?
So lots of previous people have looked at the orientation of fossils at Mistaken Point. And as you know, ascertained that Fractifusus, for example, had random orientations, whereas other fossils, such as Gianni Discus, was current aligned. What we did do, which hasn't been done before, is looked at the directionality of the clusters. So this is slightly different to orientation. It's not direction. It's not what direction the fossils are pointing in. It's whether if you go in one direction, the fossils seem closer together than another direction. So if you have, for example, organisms, a larvae or seeds or little fragments falling out of a current and landing and then settling on the sea floor, you'd expect where they settled to have a kind of very distinct direction to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something you can test for. You can see whether essentially the clusters you're seeing are oval shaped or whether they're more round.
Right, okay. And The taxon that we've been mentioning quite a lot, the clustering fractifucius, can you explain to us what that is and what it looks like? I guess it's pretty hard over audio, so hopefully we'll have pictures as well on the website, so go and have a look at those.
Yes, it is quite hard to describe. Fractifucius was kind of oval shaped. It was quite well, the length varied between 1 or 2 centimeters up to 40 centimeters, and it was about a third as wide. So for the longest ones, it would be about 10 to 15 centimeters wide. You had a kind of approximate central spine and segments off. Well, segments is probably the wrong word. And then you had branches. You had lots of branches, primary branches, that kind of met up in the center of the fractifucius. Then within each kind of branching segment structure, you have more branches and then more sub-branches.
And then would the symmetry be along the longest axis as well? Was there any symmetry across the width?
There wasn't symmetry as in the type you see in trilobites, for example. It was very much approximate. You had, in the way that kind of ferns or trees are approximately symmetric, mm-hmm. you have kind of branches that come off them, and you have branches on both sides, but they're not, you know, perfectly lined up. And the branching structures start in the middle and kind of go outwards towards the edges.
Right. So fractifucius was an organism that you find in clusters. So what could you say about these clusters based off of your spatial analysis?
So the first thing that we did when we found that, well, fractifucius, well, indeed, Clapham and previous people had shown that fractifucius was clustered, but they didn't know anything about this clustering. So the first thing we did was compare the cluster patterns to different possible types of erosional patterns on the bedding planes to eliminate that as the cause for the clustering, which we did. We then compared the clustering to heterogeneous Poisson models, which are most commonly found when you have an environmental variation, and also to Thomas cluster patterns, which is commonly seen where you have reproductive processes. And what we found was that the fractifucius followed actually double Thomas clusters on bedding surfaces E at Mistaken Point and H14 in Bonavista, which means that you had clusters of clusters.
Right.
at D surface, you had kind of single levels of clusters. And so what this told us was that the clusters, the fractifucius clusters, they weren't due to some kind of differential erosion on the bedding plane. They weren't due to the fractifucius clustering on kind of good quality substrate. They were there because fractifucius was reproducing and the babies were found near the parents.
That's pretty interesting. Can you take us through your hypothesized reproductive strategy for fractifucius?
Yes. So we actually got a very detailed idea of what was going on because we looked by looking at the different size specimens. So we had three different size groups, the large, medium and small ones. And what we found was that the larger specimens weren't actually clustered. They were randomly distributed. The medium sized clustered around the large ones and the small around the medium. If we focus on the kind of small and medium clusters first, what we did is we compared the spatial scales and the directionality of the clusters to modern processes, so modern reproductive processes. And in particular, we looked at what happens with seaweeds that release seeds or spores into the water column, what kind of clusters that produces, and also what happens when you have a reproduction using stolon or runners like strawberry plants or spider plants. And what we found with the small and medium specimens is that two key points. One is that the fractifucius clusters are actually really, really small. They're only 4 or 5 centimeters big, Whereas if you're releasing seeds into the water column, even if you're doing it in really slow currents, really close to the substrate, you get much, much bigger, like 4 or 5 times bigger clusters. We also looked at the directionality of the clusters, so whether they were essentially circular or oval. And with the small and medium specimens, what we found is that they were circular. There's no directionality. So this essentially rules out the clusters being there as a result of seeds or buds or some kind of waterborne propagule being released into the column. But the very interesting thing is that the largest ones behaved in a very different way. They were randomly distributed, they weren't clustered, and on top of that, they had a very strong directionality. So the largest ones behaved as if they had settled out of the water column, and then what they did once they were established on the water column is they started reproducing it via stolons and runners to produce a second generation, and the second generation then went on to reproduce again via stolons and runners to produce the third generation, which is how we get the double clustering that we found.
So in things like strawberries and spider plants, that when they stem off another plant, that's an asexual reproduction, isn't it?
That is correct. So the vast majority of the specimens on the bedding plains of Fatufusus will have actually been clones of their parents and indeed of their grandparents.
And those are the smaller ones, but the largest ones that reproduce differently, could that be sex?
It could be sex, but it isn't necessarily. Either the waterborne propagules could be sexually produced seeds or gametes, or they could be really, really, really tiny fragments or buds. But there's no way for us statistically to distinguish between them. So while corals and sponges, for example, reproduce by releasing spores into the water column, so it's very, very feasible that Fatufusus did this, we don't know for sure. So we can't say for certain this is the first instance of sex. It may be, but we can't conclude that definitively.
I guess it must be pretty hard without direct biological evidence. We don't know what the rangiomorphs are, but we're trying to interpret how they reproduced. So can you ever really be sure of what's going on?
I don't know if we can be sure from this. Well, we can't be sure from this type of analysis exactly how they were forming the propagules, for example. But when it comes down to looking at the spatial patterns, we literally compared all the possibilities for these clusters, and the only model that fits is reproducing via something like stolon or runners. So you've got, you know, the babies are in some way tethered to their parents for, you know, maybe a short amount of time, maybe a longer amount of time. So, I mean, from my perspective, of course, there could be things that we haven't thought of or some mode of reproduction that isn't seen anywhere else in the fossil record or today that it hasn't occurred to me to test. But I think it's pretty reasonable within the realms of, you know, how certain can you ever be about anything in the fossil record? I think we can be pretty sure of what's going on here.
Well, you say you thought of all the variables, but I sat down and had a little think and wrote down a few that I wanted to test you on.
Okay.
But I think you've actually covered the majority of them in your previous answers. So,
okay,
well done. Okay. It gets a pass from me. I've peer reviewed it and it's okay.
Okay, that's good to hear.
Have you noticed any overlapping of specimens? Because you see the big ones and then the medium ones clustered around that and the smaller ones clustered around that. Couldn't you just have a completely homogeneous layer of small ones, then the medium ones plop on top of it, and then the big one on top of all of those?
So that's an interesting idea. You do see some overlap, but it's a tiny, tiny amount. It's only a few percent compared to what it's only a few percent of specimens overlap. But we also know that you don't have three different layers, because we showed that the small ones preferentially cluster around the medium ones, so that if the medium ones had plopped on top, they'd have to be, well, they couldn't have plopped on top. I mean, if you had the large ones and then the medium ones plopped on top, they'd have to essentially move to be closer to the large ones, and we know that they couldn't move. So Yes, it's interesting idea, but I think the models wouldn't have worked if they wouldn't have fitted if that was the case. We'd be seeing different types of patterns.
Right. So now that we've considered Fractifucius, what kind of information can we get from the other Rangian morphs that are around in the area, or the other taxa? What were they doing?
So we did look at the other taxa on the other bedding planes, and we think it's likely that two of the species, for example, Primo Candelabrium and Chiny Discus, did reproduce in a similar way. But because we didn't have the numbers on other bedding planes, we can't be sure of that. So one of the things we're currently working on is extending this analysis. We're gonna go back out in the field, map out more bedding planes, get a lot more data so we can look at the reproductive patterns of other species. But also what you can do with spatial analysis is look at how the organisms interacted with each other and indeed with their environment. So we can try and get a better idea of the ecology of the situation. You know, what was the environmental impact to them? How much did each species care about all the other species? And did they have any kind of interactions, for example, competitive interactions or facilitation? And try and figure out what's going on in that respect.
And if we consider the Ediacaran localities away from Mistaken Point, can you get this kind of information from, say, the actual Ediacaran hills in Australia or the White Sea in Russia?
So there are wonderful bedding plains in Australia where you do get kind of hundreds of organisms. It gets a little bit tricky with younger assemblages because species start moving around. So you have to kind of then start subsetting the ecosystem to the ones that didn't. But yes, I would really love to extend the work out of the kind of Newfoundland into Australia and possibly Russia as well. Although I think the bedding planes there are a little bit smaller, so I don't know if we'd have the specimen numbers. The big thing that I'm doing in that respect is actually working on, I'm hoping over the next year or two to start working, well, I am starting to work. Charnwood Forest in the UK has similar aged fossils to the ones at Mistaken Point, and you again have hundreds of fossils preserved in these bedding planes. So I will be looking at them and trying to work out what was going on with the Charnwood Forest organisms and comparing them to what they were doing compared to their Newfoundland relatives.
So a month in the field mapping out all of these specimens, it's quite labour intensive, it sounds. It's quite a long trip. But then again, there are only like a few localities where you can actually get Ediacaran fossils. So do you think you'd be able to map out all of them and then get all of the spatial data?
I hope so. Over the next few years, that's what I'm hoping to do. Essentially, map out all the locality, all the communities of, say, 100 specimens or more, and so we can get a really good, strong idea of exactly what's going on. But I mean, in Newfoundland, you have dozens of surfaces. I mean, you have hundreds of bedding planes with a couple of fossils on, and you've got dozens of surfaces with communities on. So there's, you know, there is a hell of a lot of work to be done mapping out these. But it is something we are actively working on, getting back out in the field next year.
Excellent. Let me know if you need any assistance. Like a little trip to Newfoundland.
It's an interesting place. Very, very foggy.
Yeah. So if we take the results of your analysis, is there anything we can say for certain now about the biology of the Rangiomorphs from their reproductive patterns?
Well, we were really hoping that we would be able to help kind of tie down where the Rangiomorphs fit into the tree of life using this analysis. But actually, it turns out a huge amount of very, very different organisms reproduce using stolon and also kind of some kind of propagules. So you have plants, which we talked about. You also have fungi in a kind of roundabout sort of way do similar things. They produce hyphae mats and then they have fruiting bodies that can release spores. But you also get a couple of admittedly rather rare species of cnidarian and tunicates that produce little stolon and form little colonies. So I think on its own, it can't help tie down the phylogeny, but hopefully kind of over the next few years, as people are working more and more on Ediacaran phylogenies, it might help to help kind of further along
our understanding of what they are.
Yes, a further along our understanding of what they are, yes.
Did the size of the individual, is that dictated by its generation?
We believe so. It seems a reasonable hypothesis, and it's actually something that I think people are going to be testing over the next year or two. The vast majority of animals, the bigger they are, animals, creatures, living organisms, the bigger they are, the older they are. But you do get some shrinkage in for some kind of marine creatures where, you know, for example, that resource is limited. I mean, there's no evidence of resource limitation at Mistaken Point. So it is certainly reasonable. And our analysis also supports this to some extent, because you don't see... you know, the small ones are clustered around the medium ones around the large ones, in the way that you'd expect if the small ones were the youngest and the large ones were the oldest. You don't have kind of large ones, for example, clustering around a medium one. You don't see that kind of potential variation. So it is certainly the most likely case, but it's something that needs to be kind of definitively confirmed at some point.
Mm-hmm. And then can we see any more than three generations in one cluster? Do you get tiny, tiny little ones around the small ones as well?
Oh, no, unfortunately, we don't see that. We haven't found four generations yet. But the smallest specimens we find on the H14 surface are only a centimetre big. So it's not going to be... while preservation is sub... millimeter, it might be quite hard. Well, no, if there were lots of like millimeter fractifusus, I think we would see them, or millimeter or two, but it would be pretty hard on other bedding surfaces. So and that would be wonderful, but we haven't found a fourth generation anywhere. Have to keep looking.
Right, looking ahead now to what you're going to be doing with further analyses, is there anything else we can actually test using your data?
So I think the big thing for me is looking at how the different species interacted with each other and with their environment. I think that's a kind of next immediate step. Because we're not sure really what's going on with them in that respect.
And do you think we'll ever get to a stage where we understand what the rangiomorphs actually were?
I do hope so. It is incredibly hard to work out, but we, you know, there are a lot of very intelligent people working on exactly that question, trying to work out Ediacaran phylogenies. But the difficulty is kind of testing hypotheses, because they look so weird and wonderful.
Do you think that we actually already know what they are? They are just rangiomorphs. They're not related to anything.
So they quite likely are some extinct eukaryotic clade, but working out how exactly that ties into life, because on some, you know, while they're incredibly different, plants and animals and fungi are all related to each other. It's just going kind of way, way, way back. So rangiomorphs will tie in somewhere, but it's just a question of working out where, and kind of whether they're very, very distinct or actually very, very animal-like, for example.
And so to wrap up, as a theoretical physicist by training, someone who fell in love with the rangiomorphs and the Ediacaran biota, what can you say to enthuse others about this group?
So the rangiomorphs were the kind of first complicated organisms in the fossil record. You do get some other life forms that looked a lot like algae, but these are the first kind of... animal-like, you know, really kind of complicated from a tissue perspective, I guess, really complicated organisms. And so if we can understand better what they were, we can understand really what's going on right when essentially the animals were evolving for the first time and around that sort of time. But we can also, I'm quite interested in why they're not no longer around. And I think to some extent that scientists in general can learn a lot more from mistakes than, or kind of unsuccessful attempts, and by looking at success. So if we can understand what the rangiomorphs were and, you know, why they didn't last very long, why they died out, it should help us understand much more clearly what it takes to be successful with life on Earth.
Okay, Emily, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for talking to me.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.